Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how ageism is shading the conversation about President Biden's candidacy.
And how Arizona's arts community will be impacted by cuts to the Arizona Commission on the Arts budget.
But first, new water restrictions are coming to California. The State Water Resources Control Board earlier this month adopted new rules that'll phase in cutbacks to water suppliers across the state. The enforcement of those conservation targets is expected to start in 2027. These new rules have been under consideration for several years and have gone through different iterations over that time. With me to talk more about them is Rachel Becker, water reporter at Cal Matters. And Rachel, what exactly do these new water rules say?
Yeah, so basically what they do is they set individualized water budgets for urban water suppliers in California. There are about 400 of these suppliers that these budgets will apply to, serving about 95% of the population. And what these budgets will do is tighten over time. And the goal is to create conservation measures that are really much more individualized to the different regions and different needs across the big state of California. And so the budgets are calculated from a number of different factors, including standards for indoor water use that tighten over time, outdoor water use at residences as well, certain landscape water uses, and losses in systems like leaks. And then water users can also apply for, or water suppliers, that is, water suppliers can apply for variances that basically take some of the heat off.
Why was the decision made to have these regulations go through those suppliers as opposed to, you know, individual homeowners or businesses or the actual end users?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know that I can speak to the original legislator's intent at the time, but that is an important distinction to make, is that these regulations do apply to the suppliers and not the users. And so it will be up to each individual suppliers to figure out how exactly they want to meet the conservation needs, whether it's going to be through offering rebates or through instituting a use-based rate structure in which higher water users have to pay higher fees. And I think part of the impetus was to give kind of more local control and not a one-size-fits-all approach.
Sure. So how much water ultimately do supporters say that this plan will save?
Water Board staff estimate that through 2040, the measures will save 1.7 million acre feet total. And that's enough to supply about half of California's population for a year. And through 2050, the savings could reach about 3.9 million acre feet. And so that's more than a year's supply for the state's entire population. That is a substantial reduction, though, from previous versions, which would have saved about 6.3 million acre feet through 2040.
So you've reported on some of the, you know, the twists and turns of this policy as it was going through the process of being developed and then ultimately finalized. And it seems as though in the end, it has people who are both pleased with it and people who maybe liked earlier versions and people who just never liked any of it to begin with.
There are a lot of opinions on water in California, which is a huge surprise.
Yeah.
So, earlier on, there were pretty massive cost and benefits estimates attached to the earlier versions of the regulation, and analysis by the state's legislative analyst's office, which basically can advise the legislature and does pretty deep dives into policies and regulations and such. They questioned whether the benefits of the new rules would ultimately outweigh the costs and kind of urged the Water Board to relax some of the requirements, extend some deadlines, and give a little more wiggle room for the suppliers. And so, and the state's regulators at the Water Resources Control Board, they seem to have taken that feedback extended some deadlines, gave some alternate compliance pathways, especially for suppliers facing much larger cuts of 20 to 30% or more. And the costs and the benefits have dropped substantially of the in the latest version. However, there also seems to have been an accounting error, which also helped drive down the costs and the benefits. Yes, and so now kind of the verdict is suppliers say that it'll still be challenging to meet these ambitious targets. They're still concerned about cost impacts for lower income and fixed income members of their communities, but I think many that I heard from at the meeting were pleased to see some of the changes. Environmental groups and the lawmakers who wrote the laws that then led to these regulations back in 2018 were more disappointed with the final verdict from the Water Board approving the latest regulations, saying that these don't necessarily lead to as much conservation as California needs. State Assembly member Laura Friedman, said after the vote that the state's regulators essentially decided to kick the can of California's water future down the road at a time when we can least afford such inaction. That latter half of that was a quote. And even the Water Board chair, Joaquin Esquivel, said, this is not a perfect regulation, but he said it was a significant one.
So for folks who, study water and are involved in the water world in California, do they see this as the solution to what's going on? Do they see it as a part of the solution? Like how big of a part of the dealing with scarcer water supplies is this plan? Like, where does it fit?
I think conservation is often considered to be among the more low-hanging fruits for California. That said, for increasing kind of resilience in the face of protracted water scarcity. That said, the Water Board Chair Esquivel said that these conservation regulations are not policies in isolation, that this creates a floor. But there are other efforts that are additive.
So more could happen in addition to this policy.
Well, there are many other efforts that the state government is looking into to address California's water supply issues. These are all heavily controversial, and their effectiveness is very debated among proponents and critics. One of the proposals that California Governor Gavin Newsom has been strongly supporting is a decades-old proposal to basically reroute water that is currently funneled south from Northern California to reroute that around the California Delta. So that is one conversation that's happening around California's water supply. Another conversation that's happening is around the proposed Sites Reservoir to increase storage. But again, that one as well is also heavily controversial. So this conversation about conservation is occurring at the same time as conversations about those massive infrastructure efforts as well. And so I guess we'll see how they all play out in tandem.
Okay, that is Rachel Becker, water reporter with Cal Matters. Rachel, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Democrats this week are still in turmoil as some call for President Biden to pull out of the presidential race and others stick by him after his faltering debate performance last month. Polls still held the presidential race essentially even last week, but it's not yet clear how the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump at a rally over the weekend or his announcement of vice president candidate J.D. Vance will affect the race. In all of the political debate over what's next in this tumultuous election year, our next guest says there's one thing we're not talking enough about, ageism. Reverend Lynn Castile Harper is a minister, essayist, chaplain, and author of the book On Vanishing: Mortality, Dementia, and What It Means to Disappear. And in a recent piece for America magazine, she argues that, quote, ageism is so ubiquitous in American culture as to be invisible, and it's making it impossible for us to judge President Biden clearly. I spoke with her more about it earlier this morning, beginning with her reaction to Biden's rocky debate.
You know, Lauren, I certainly recognize that it was wobbly and not what anyone would consider top debating form. And yet I didn't spiral down in kind of this alarmism and deep, deep worry, partly because I understand that a presidency is much more than a moment. And that often what happens, especially in the context of ageism, is that we can get hyper-focused, especially when older people make mistakes or aren't in their best form, and begin to extrapolate all kinds of negative conclusions about their total competency. So no, I wasn't particularly alarmed or concerned about his universal capacity to lead.
Can you define ageism for us? Like, you compare it to reducing anyone to one aspect of their identity, right?
Right. So reducing someone to one aspect of their identity, in this case, age or old age, and then dismissing someone because of it. So, you know, I think about ageism as discrimination against older people, largely based on inaccurate and negative stereotypes.
So you talked about your own reaction to the president's debate performance. I want to ask you about what you make of the broader reaction from media, culture, columnists, et cetera, to that debate performance. Why do you think it looked the way it did?
You know, I think that there's this dynamic when we talk about ageism, and what I was hoping to get at with my article is not weighing in on, you know, yes, Biden should stay in the running or no, he shouldn't, but to see how ageism warps the question and our lens that we bring to it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the warping factors that I began to see immediately is this hypervisibility versus invisibility, this double bind of visibility that comes with ageism. So what I mean by that is, with hypervisibility, it's the over-scrutinizing of every slip, every flub, and assigning all these perceived deficits to old age, and then assigning old age to incompetence, universal incompetence. And so it becomes this kind of funhouse mirror and doesn't allow us to kind of step back and take a beat and really fairly judge what is most important in a leader.
Hmm. And you're not arguing here for Biden to stay in the race or for Biden to drop out. You're writing, like you said, that you're concerned with the ways in which ageism distorts the way we even look at the question. You also say, like, Biden and his team haven't really shaped this in a helpful way either. Like, they could have taken advantage of his age in some ways, you think?
Exactly. I think ageism, one of its manifestations is that we define our worth, or our worth is defined by able-bodied youthfulness. And I'm not sure the Biden campaign has done a great job of pushing back against that narrative. I think about some years ago when a man challenged Biden's old age as disqualifying, and Biden immediately challenged him to a push-up contest. And, you know, to me, that's not a helpful response, because it seeds the premise that old age is inherently disqualifying. And it also says, yes, my worth is defined by these particular capacities that are linked to able-bodied youthfulness. Mm. What if instead the conversation had gone another way, that yes, I'm not the same person I was a decade or two or three ago. And guess what? That's a good thing. My judgment's gotten keener. I wouldn't make the same decisions, like, say, voting for the Iraq war, you know, now with all this experience professionally and personally at my back. In other words, owning aging for what it is. A long life gives us the potential of refining our senses, refining our perspective. And yes, there are limitations and challenges, and it's not to deny age, but it's to say that age can bring other things other than just challenge and limitation and deficit.
That's such a countercultural way of looking at it today, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think that's what's so stilting and upsetting about what we're seeing in the media, is that there seems to be this universal assumption that aging is bad, and that to show your worth, show that you're not aging, which is just not a realistic or helpful way for any of us to live, not only older people, but all of us across the lifespan.
Do you think, though, Lynn, there are legitimate concerns here, though, like that it's fair for people to be concerned about the president's capabilities and kind of in the context of this long history of cover-ups of presidential health problems?
I think it's important that we don't take off the table questions of competency. Absolutely. I think where ageism and ableism really come into play, and why it's so important we have some utility with understanding how they function, is that the way we even approach competence becomes skewed.
How does ageism affect, like, the rest of us, Lynn? Like, we're talking about the president of the United States, like, you know, probably the most famous person in the world. Like, what about the rest of society, the rest of people who are aging?
Right, right. And, you know, I think a lot of times ageism is framed as like, oh, it's just about, you know, kind of inappropriate birthday cards or anti-aging skin products, which are actual kind of assaults on us as we age. But ageism has a really pernicious effect. You know, people are barred from, kept out of, fired in employment situations. Age discrimination in the workplace is a huge problem that has economic effects on how people age. You know, healthcare disparities for older people mean, you know, negative outcomes. So ageism isn't just innocuous, and it affects all of us. And it also creates an environment where when any of us have a limitation or any of us have something that needs accommodation, or we're changing physically or mentally or cognitively, it creates a very stigmatizing environment if we can't come forward and be truthful about that, and also truthful about those things that, within ourselves that are our gifts, and to be able to kind of hold all of that through every stage of life seems like a more hopeful and helpful way to live for all of us.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Lynn Castile Harper, minister, essayist, and chaplain, and author of the book On Vanishing: Mortality, Dementia, and What It Means to Disappear. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk this through. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, being able to remember everything may seem like a superpower, but it can also be a curse.
She not only remembers, you know, happy things, she remembers every sad thing, every disappointment, and she remembers them in such excruciating detail that it's like she's living through those moments again. She's a very unhappy person because she feels like she can never escape her past.
We'll hear more about a rare condition that makes it impossible to forget.
But first, the Arizona Commission on the Arts was among those entities that got less money in the new state budget than it had hoped for. But there had been talk of it not getting any money either. Christina Yusun Park is the new executive director of the commission. She's been on the job for less than a month. She stopped by the studio recently to talk about her new role. And we started with what about this job is appealing and interesting to her.
The moment I saw this position, it's just an incredible opportunity. I've been here in the Arizona arts ecosystem for 14 plus years. And the Arizona Commission on the Arts is just a core backbone in terms of supporting artists, organizations, and programmatic activity here in Arizona.
And as you reference, you yourself are a working artist. How do you think that experience will translate into maybe more of a managerial type role?
I see it as a critical part. For me, I've been an artist, a grant maker, and now as the ED of the Arizona Commission, it allows me to join the agency in a way of humility and also of understanding how applicants feel as they apply to our grant programs.
It's an interesting point because I would imagine if you've never been on the other side of it, if you've never gone through the process of asking for financial help mm-hmm. and going through the process of trying to get it, it might help you in your effort to get that money out, knowing what it's like on the other side.
Absolutely. I am very commiserate with my other artists and art organizations that may have pushed the submit button at 11:59 p.m. on application day, but also about the way of how can we provide more equitable services for artists and organizations as they apply. How can we make how can I support the staff's efforts in order to make applications simpler, more equitable, and more accessible to the whole state?
So let's talk about the kinds of grants you might be able to hand out, because the recently enacted state budget had less money in it for mm-hmm. your agency than what has had in the past. How does that impact what you're able to do?
Unfortunately, this current budget situation does impact the amount of support dollars that we can send to artists and art and cultural organizations. And for the past 2 years, the state legislature has been really generous in providing us a one-time appropriation each year for $5 million, of which the full $5 million immediately gets facilitated and sent to artists and art and cultural organizations here in Arizona. And this being a very difficult budget year, we were tasked with grappling with what would it look like with a zero budget allocation, of which the staff at the Arizona Commission of the Arts did a fantastic job really thinking that through. And we were fortunate this year to be $2 million, but that is a 60% decrease from the years before. And so this is something that not only for our agency to deal with, but also the artists, individuals, organizations at the end of the day that we re-grant the full amount to.
So what does that mean maybe you won't be able to do that the agency had been able to do in previous years since you have less money?
With the $2 million that we have this year and the 60% cut to the one-time appropriation from the state legislature, we're currently working with our board. But what it will look like is grants that are smaller, fewer grants that are sent out from our agency this year.
I would imagine, though, when you reference thinking about what a zero appropriation would look like, the state of Florida recently zeroed out its arts commission. Is this the kind of deal where $2 million is not what you were hoping for, but it's better than what you could have had?
Absolutely. Over the last year, with the potential impact of a zero state allocation to our department, there's been a lot of difficult decisions and conversations about what that would look like. Our department is incredibly cost efficient in the way that we manage funds, but $0 is $0. So I really do want to thank the governor's office and the legislature for giving us $2 million. But there's a part where I want to emphasize that this is a one-time allocation every single year that our agency, the Arizona Citizens on the Arts, as well as the community, has to ask for year after year. And so that creates an environment of volatility for not only us, but also for the individuals and organizations that depend on our funds.
Yeah, I'm curious what, in your mind, that means for the arts community here, that, you know, every year you could get zero, you could get $5 million, you could get some other amount more or less. What does that mean for the artists who are doing their art here, who maybe rely on these grants?
The artists rely on these grants to pay rent. They rely on these grants in order to survive. And so it is directly impacting individuals and organizations who have to make salaries at the end of the day. And there is incredible crushing sort of impact for these individuals and organizations when they don't know if they're going to get the funds at the end of the day each year.
What to you is the impact on the state of the arts? Like, why is it important that there are arts grants in Arizona?
Having a vibrant arts and culture community here in the state of Arizona is incredibly beneficial to the communities as well as the economic infrastructure that makes up our businesses here in Arizona. The impact of the arts, there is extensive research about the impact of the arts and culture sector on K through 12 learning outcomes, retention for students. And then also there's research that clearly defines the impact on lifestyle, on what does it mean to be happy, which I think we're going towards at, here in the sort of post-COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that you're going to be able to continue making art in this new role?
So as an individual artist, I think that my artistic practice has changed a lot over the years. When I first came here to Arizona, I was a sculptor doing public art. And when I think of my practice now, it's really about supporting the community that has really held me through these years. And so there's small parts where I also play in a community band, and that really supports me in a way that the ways I just actually just talked about, that's demonstrated through data.
What does success to you in this role look like?
I have some really ambitious goals here. I think that really addressing the financial volatility of the one-time appropriation is huge. And so success for me looks like stability for the arts and culture sector here in Arizona.
How would you try to do that?
So it's working together and building on the incredible work that has been done up to this point with our governor-appointed commission and then also our incredible advocacy body, the Arizona Commission on the Arts. And with this last legislative session, we have incredible allies that have really worked hard to get us back onto the budget this year. And so building on that momentum in order to advocate for this stability for the arts and culture sector here in Arizona. And I do want to add, too, that the Arizona Commission on the Arts, I have a lot of respect for over the past few years because of the way that it's been managed fiscally conservative and the fact that the one-time appropriation is not the full budget. Actually, the one-time appropriation, 100% of those funds go directly back out to individuals and organizations. And there's been other sources of revenue in order to make up for the programming that we provide to the state, as well as staffing.
That is Christina Yusun Park, the new Arizona Commission on the Arts Executive Director. Christina, it was nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The 2024 Summer Olympics start pretty soon, and some Arizonans will be there to represent the Grand Canyon State. And this morning, we're going to meet one of them, one of the youngest of them, for that matter. Paige Hine is a 16-year-old skateboarder from Tempe who's heading to her first Olympics this week. She told me she's been skating for most of her life.
I was 4 when I got my first skateboard, but didn't start like actually getting into it till I was 8.
8 years old. So this is, you know, half of your life that you've been skateboarding, and you've gone from, you know, being an 8-year-old on a skateboard for the first time to now heading to the Olympics. Let's talk about how that happened. Like, when did skateboarding become something you really love and something that's competitive for you?
I always loved it. Like, after I actually skated for the first time, I fell in love and I've been skating since then. And then in 2019, I got invited to Sao Paulo, Brazil, and it was like my first time out of the country, first time traveling for skateboarding that far away, and I was like, oh wow, this is like pretty serious. I was skating every day. I'd wake up, skate in my like garage, go to school, come back, skate in the garage, and then I'd go like skate for 4 hours at the skate park.
So tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that you do when you're skating in the Olympics. Like, it's a pretty new event. It's only been in the Olympics for a couple of years. What are the categories? What does the track look like? How's it gonna look for people watching it on TV?
There's street and there's park. I do street. It's like rails and ledges and a lot of like board flipping.
Mm-hmm.
And like some of my signature stuff is skating switch. And that's like either you're goofy or regular, and I'm regular, so when I skate goofy, we call it switch, and it scores really good, and it's big tricks, because not a lot of people do them.
Wait, you're going to have to define some things there for us. What's the difference between goofy and regular there?
Regular is when your left foot is in front of you, like your left foot's first, and then goofy is when your right foot is first on the board.
That's funny. It's called goofy. I love that. So tell us about competing at this level. Like, was there a moment, a competition, a coach, like some time when you realized that you were not just competitive in skateboarding, but that you were, you know, that you were one of the best?
Last year, I had a really good year. And in Switzerland, I got third, and it was like my first time podiuming on a big contest. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it was kind of just one after another.
Tell us about all the places you've been, the experiences that you've had so far at such a young age in skateboarding. Like, did you ever think it would take you this far?
I definitely did not think it would take me this far, but it's honestly the best thing ever. I get to explore and see different places and different cultures, and I've been everywhere, like Japan, I've been a couple times, Switzerland, Rome, Dubai, Budapest, China, all over the place.
But you're still 16. You're in high school, I'm assuming. Did you have to, you know, homeschool or do school differently because you're, you know, basically a professional skateboarder now?
Yeah, I do online school now through like a Olympic kind of program. Huh. So it's like made easier for your schedule. But in September last year is when I was like, do I sign back up for school? And it's as we were traveling to Switzerland. And I was like, I'm going to sign up, be 2 weeks behind already. And so it just didn't seem realistic.
That's really interesting. So let me ask you about the skate scene here in Phoenix. Like, I don't really know this world, but I know it is kind of a whole culture in and of itself, right? Like, what's the skate scene look like here? Are there a lot of places to skate? Are there a lot of people who are into this and are supportive of each other?
Yeah, the skate culture out here is great. There's a lot of skate parks, but of course it's really hot. There's these indoor parks called KTR, and it's like trampoline and skate park.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where like Jagger Eaton, he's also going to the Olympics and he's from here. His dad like owns all of those. And so I grew up skating there and training there.
I wonder this about skateboarding, right? Because this is like a pretty risky sport in terms of injuries, I'm guessing. Like, do you fall a lot? Do you think it takes a certain kind of personality for somebody to want to do something like this?
Yeah, you do fall a lot, really hard into hard ground, but I feel like you kind of just get used to it. I don't know. A lot of repetition of it comes natural.
So let's talk about heading to Paris. Are you excited? Are you nervous? Like, talk a little bit about your goals for not just the competition itself in the Olympics here, but for what you want to get out of the experience.
I'm definitely more excited than nervous, a little bit nervous, but I just really want to like have fun and enjoy the moment because I've worked so hard to get here, had so many ups and downs, and I made it. Mm-hmm. So might as well just have the best time and do my very best.
So like I mentioned, this will only be the second Olympics where skateboarding's, you know, even been a sport that can compete. I wonder what you're thinking heading into that. Like, do you think that skateboarding is misunderstood and you know, like as you're surrounded by all of these other athletes from all over the world who are the best in their sports, do you think that you'll have explaining to do?
I think we'll definitely have some explaining to do. Like, talking to other sports, it's a lot different. They all have, like, the whole routine that they go through, and we kind of just skate.
Yeah.
And it's pretty nude for us to be like this serious about it in the Olympics, but I think it's really good for skateboarding and the culture.
What do you think is good about that? Like, what do you think that putting skateboarding in the Olympics has done already and will do in the future for your sport?
I like that it's shown that you can actually get somewhere in skating, because I feel like a lot of people just like see skaters and think like, oh, they're just destroying stuff and like skating in front of like my house and stuff.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But it's not just that. And it's really good to like have especially like the girls in it and show other girls that they can do a sport like this too.
Yeah. So even if you win a gold medal in Paris, will you still be back here kind of skating on the streets in Tempe or at KTR there when you get back?
Yeah, definitely.
That was my conversation with Paige Hine, the 16-year-old from Tempe who is heading to the 2024 Summer Olympics in skateboarding. She told me she leaves for Paris tomorrow.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. What was the first piece of candy you received the first time you went trick-or-treating? What did you have for dinner while you were watching the series finale of your favorite TV show? Can you write out the dialogue from your fourth date with your spouse? If those questions stress you out because you can't remember the answers, consider the alternative. What if those memories, along with almost everything else that's ever happened to you, were impossible to forget? That's the situation faced by a small but fascinating group of people known as hyperthymesiacs. There are only about 100 known cases of this extremely rare phenomenon, which is sometimes referred to as HSAM, Highly Superior Autobiographical Memory. Alisa Gabbert is the author of a collection of essays called Any Person is the Only Self. In an excerpt from the collection that recently appeared in the Paris Review, Gabbert profiles a hyperthymesiac and explores the curious history of the condition. She recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about the blessing and the curse of being unable to forget.
So hyperthymesia is what is called excessive remembering or highly specific autobiographical memory. And it's not the same as, say, having what they call a photographic memory or just a really good memory. It's not like those people that train themselves to memorize the order of a deck of cards or digits of pi. Instead, it's just this natural ability, or some researchers, some scientists who study this condition would actually say it's a disability, where you just don't ever forget anything about your own life.
And one of the people that you profile in your essay is Jill Price.
Yeah, so Jill Price was the first known case. And she was really, you know, the subject that started all this kind of media attention around the condition. And she was doing a lot of talk shows and stuff at the time. A lot of news stories were coming out about her, and she was on Diane Sawyer. And, you know, typically when she was doing these appearances, what people would do to kind of test whether this condition was true or she was some kind of fraud, they would call out a date to her. It had to be a date from her, you know, conscious lifetime, because hyperthymesiacs, they remember their own lives, not, you know, they don't remember history particularly well. And so she was calling out names from, you know, some kind of almanac.
Princess Grace dies
September 14th, 1982. That was the first day I started 12th grade.
And Diane Sawyer was looking at this book in her lap where she was using it as her source. And she said, no, actually, that's not correct. You got it off by a couple of days.
September 10th, 1982.
What happened on that day?
Princess Grace died yesterday, it says. So September 10th.
Well, that night might not be right.
And Jill was so sure. She was like, well, you know, maybe the book is wrong. And then somebody from backstage, some assistant or something, looked up the fact in another source.
The book is wrong.
What? The book is wrong?
I told you. Because I know what I was doing that day. I literally started 12th grade that day and came home from school and found out, and I was really upset.
She really knew this stuff, and it wasn't because she had, you know, consciously set out to memorize it. She just remembered every day of her life.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And I think this media fascination with folks who have hyperthymesia speaks to the question of whether or not this is an ability or a disability. Can you talk about why there are some researchers who consider it a disability?
You know, memory is not completely understood, like, you know, so much of everything, right? Yeah. So much about our bodies and our minds and the world and the universe. Like, we don't know everything about how memory works. And for example, we don't know why we don't have any memories from early childhood. Some people think it's because we haven't really learned how to remember things yet. Some people think it's because we don't have language and language helps us codify our memories. Other people think it's because our forgetting is better than our memory at that age. And so there's a theory that people with hyperthymesia are just very, very bad at forgetting, but forgetting is really useful. And the way this shows up in Jill Price's life, for example, is that she not only remembers, you know, happy things, she remembers every sad thing, every disappointment, and she remembers them in such excruciating detail that it's like she's living through those moments again.
Yeah.
And so she's a very unhappy person because she feels like she can never escape her past.
Yeah. I mean, one of the parts of the essay that was most heartbreaking for me is a quote from Jill Price where because she can remember everything, she does this thing she calls Y diagramming, where she goes back over what happened and then tries to think about, well, what if I hadn't done this at that time, then maybe this wouldn't have happened or maybe this wouldn't have happened. And she says, it has instilled in me an acute, persistent regret.
I know. It's so sad.
It really is. It really is. But this part of the essay is where you make what I think is a really fascinating pivot, because one of the things that Jill does is she keeps an exhaustive journal. And she says, I don't write to remember. I write so I don't go crazy. What was interesting to you about that?
I've always been really interested in memory. And so part of what made Jill Price such a figure of fascination for me was, you know, this connection between her truly exceptional memory and her sort of strange journaling habits, and how it was somehow a comfort or a coping mechanism for her to be able to externalize all of the details of her own life and of her memories that were in her head, and how that expurged something that helped her somehow handle it a little bit better. There's something about it that makes it a little easier to process the details of our own lives by just getting it out of our heads.
Yes. Well, Jill says that she writes because it makes the memories something she can handle. And you say, by handle, I think she means both that she can touch it and that because she can touch it, she can process and accept it. Most of us can cope with it insofar as we can cope with it because the reality passes so quickly and then begins to fade. But for someone in Jill's position, it seems like the journal is a way of coaxing the fade.
Right. Or, you know, because she doesn't have that, you know, that lucky ability that most of us have, where fading does happen so kind of naturally and quickly, it's almost wishful, like a wishful act. As though by writing this down, I know that, you know, if this is in pencil or in ink, it's eventually going to fade. And she has said that she wants these diaries to be burned or buried with her when she dies. And I think that's a fascinating desire, and that it shows that she sees it as like her sort of external mind, and she wants that mind to die with her, with her actual mind.
Yeah. But it also suggests that she does not view this as some kind of superpower or something that she's grateful for or excited to have, and that the keeping of these journals seems very much like a survival mechanism rather than some attempt to prove that, you know, she's like some kind of sorcerer.
Right. I think it makes her feel like the memories are real if she can write them down.
Yes. But all of this leads us to what for me is like the money quote from your piece that I haven't been able to stop thinking about, which is, a journal is an effigy of the self, or else is the self that exists because we create it.
Yeah. Well, the self is the project of the journal or the diary. It's kind of a proving ground in a way, you know, just the idea that, you know, once you put something in words on paper, even if it's just in a notebook, even if it's not published in a book, it's more real. You're making reality that way.
Yeah. Well, Elisa Gabbert, author of the upcoming book, Any Person is the Only Self, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Mark, I know you're a big baseball fan.
Yes.
Will you be watching the All-Star game tonight?
I will make sure to watch at least when the Yankees batters are up.
But I know you're a Yankees fan.
At least when Aaron Judge and Juan Soto are hitting. But, you know, the D-backs also will be represented pretty well there.
That's right. Diamondbacks manager Torrey Lovello will manage the National League squad, an honor he gets because of the D-backs World Series appearance last season.
Indeed. And he has picked his own second baseman, Ketel Marte. He'll be the National League's leadoff hitter.
He's the only D-back to be named to the All-Star team this year, but he's having what Sports Illustrated called an MVP-caliber season. I looked it up, Mark. That's what they say.
Okay.
So we're still pretty proud, right?
You can indeed. You can tune in tonight to cheer Marte and the rest of the All-Stars on. The game is at 5 from the Texas Rangers home stadium in Arlington, Texas.
All right, well, Mark will say go Yankees, but I will say go D-backs tonight.
Well, I mean, it's all, you know, they're all National League, American League teams in the All-Star game.
Yeah.
It's all for fun. It's all for good fun.
It's all for fun, and I'm sure it will be. So thanks for listening to the show this Tuesday. Be sure to join us tomorrow. We'll have much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.